From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations. Dr. Robert Ross, the president and CEO of the California Endowment, looks at the future of Obamacare under the Trump administration. And opera singer Ryan Speedo Green talks about his unlikely rise to stardom. But first, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign surprised the political and media establishment, in part because his platform, which was often criticized as being too left-wing, resonated with so many ordinary Americans. He has written about his campaign in a new book. It's called Our Revolution, A Future to Believe In. In the text, he also shares some of his policy positions. Senator Sanders, good to have you on this program, sir.
Great to be with you, Tavis.
I know that on all the other shows you've appeared, you've been asked repeatedly to offer your post-mortem on the election. I'm going to spare you those questions because you've been asked them everywhere else. And I want to talk about something different, what you actually have in the book as a plan for the future. It is the case that every election is never about the past, always about the future. So let's talk about how we navigate our way forward in the future and not do any more post-mortem questions, as legitimate as those questions may be. I want to take your list of 10 things to fix America in reverse order. Number 10 on your list is corporate media and the threat to our democracy. That's a bold statement, that corporate media is a threat to our democracy. Unpack it for me.
Okay, here's where we are with that. And this is an issue that is never discussed, certainly not on corporate media. What you got today, Tavis, is about a half a dozen major media conglomerates that own and control the distribution of the information that the American people receive. That is a massive concentration of control. And what is never discussed about is, what is the goal of these major media conglomerates? Is it to educate the American people? Is it to give the five sides of the issue? No. Their function as major media conglomerates owned by very large financial interest is to make as much money as they possibly can. That is their interest. Now, what does that mean in the day-to-day life of the American people? It means that, number one, in a campaign the likes of which we have just had, over 90% of media, television, for example, did not discuss the important issues facing the American people. They were devoted, their coverage was devoted to political gossip, to polling, to money being raised, the stupid things the candidates said, to personalities, rather than saying, okay, here are the problems facing the American people, and this is how candidate Trump feels about it, candidate Clinton, or candidate Sanders feels about it. You decide which proposal makes more sense to you. In other words, the campaign was not presented as an issue impacting the American people, but more of a personality contest between the different candidates. That is a disaster for democracy. Second point, if anybody thinks that advertising on television does not play an important role in terms of what gets covered, you are sorely mistaken. Climate change, according to the scientific community, is the great global crisis that we face. Yet there is unbelievably little coverage of climate change. And I believe that has a lot to do with a lot of the fossil fuel advertising and the special interests that dominate television. So those are some of the issues that concern me about media.
How did you process, as I move quickly to get to these other things on your list, how did you process in the campaign not getting the kind of media coverage? And this is not Tavis kissing up to Bernie Sanders. The data is clear and everywhere about this. How did you process Trump sucking the air out of the room, the media room, that is, and Bernie Sanders having to fight to get coverage at all?
Look, we had the misfortune about speaking about the real issues impacting the American people. That's not a good way to get media coverage. You want me to get media coverage? Tavis Smiley is a dash, dash, dash. Wow, that's a lot. That's really interesting. Let's go through that. Bernie Sanders said this about Tavis. Tavis said this about Bernie. We can go on for weeks on that. But if I talk about why the middle class in this country is in decline, why we have a grotesque level of income and wealth inequality, well, you know, that's kind of wonkish.
Yeah.
That's kind of boring. Who wants to talk about that? So that's the kind of problem that we have. Now, Trump, who is nobody's fool, understands. You say outrageous things, you got the media all over your place. And it's not just Bernie Sanders. If you talk to people like Marco Rubio, you talk to people like Governor Bush, Jeb Bush, they got You know, Trump got infinitely more coverage than they got because media likes that. And that's a real problem for democracy.
So finally, before I move on, what then do you make of the media's complicity in helping to create Donald Trump as juxtaposed now with their rush to normalize his election?
Well, I think it is no secret. There were quotes, I think, from the head of CBS, the head of CNN, and that is that Donald Trump is great for business. We put Donald Trump on. We have him attacking Hillary Clinton or his Republican opponents. A lot of people watch. It is great TV, a lot of advertising. We make money. But, you know, I think that I got to tell you, I'm not here to say to the corporate media, reform yourself. I don't think that that's going to happen. I think what we have to do is through the internet, through good shows like yours, focus on the real issues impacting the American people. I don't think the corporate media is going to do it. I think the conflicts of interest are just too great.
Number 9 on your list, Senator Sanders, of how to fix America is to protect our most vulnerable. If Americans really cared about the most vulnerable, wouldn't this outcome have been different?
Sure, it would have. What, again, the media does not talk about, what was not discussed in this campaign, is a very simple reality. Tavis, if we were a poor country, and God knows there are poor countries throughout the world, we would say, well, it is terrible that elderly people are barely making it, that they can't afford their medicine, that disabled veterans are suffering, that veterans are sleeping out on the street. Bottom line is, we are the richest country in the history of the world. And if I have to say that 100 times a day, 7 days a week, I will say that. We are the wealthiest country. We can and must do well for all of our people. There is no excuse not talked about. Media is not interested in this one. You got millions of people who are trying to get by today on $10,000, $11,000, $12,000 Social Security. People with elderly people, people with disabilities, disabled vets. You can't do it. Who talks about it? Who knows that they exist? They are hurting. As a compassionate democratic society, our job is, in fact, to protect the most vulnerable. That is the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor. Poor, poverty. You tell me, Tavis, how often is the word poverty mentioned?
Yeah.
You got 43 million people. This is living in poverty, an issue not discussed. Of course, we can't afford to take care of the most vulnerable people in our society.
Number 8 on your list is immigration reform now. I'm trying to juxtapose your call for immigration reform now with Mr. Trump saying just days ago that one of the first things he's going to do is to deport 2 million people.
Not if I have anything to say about it. Look, we got, nobody knows exactly, but we think we have 10, 11 million undocumented people in this country. Many of them, vast majority of them are working hard. Many of them are getting ripped off by their employers, underpaid, because they have no legal rights to defend themselves. You got kids, young Latino kids, scared to death. They're going to go home from school tomorrow. Their mom or their dad may be deported. What the American people want, and by the way, as in many other issues, Trump's view is a minority view, a minority view. The American people, by and large, want to see comprehensive immigration reform and a path toward citizenship. That is something that I will fight for.
Number 7 on your list is real criminal justice reform. Now, here it gets tricky for me because we know where Mr. Trump stands on the issue of criminal justice reform. He's all about law and order, law and order, law and order. We heard that 1,000 times, law and order, law and order. What's trickier, though, that Secretary Clinton, of course, is married to a guy who made some really bad moves and had to apologize for it later with regard to criminal justice reform. So I, quite frankly, am not sure if she had won or the fact that he has won means that any real criminal justice reform was actually going to come forth. What do you think ought to happen, though?
This is what ought to happen. And by the way, for a variety of reasons, this is one area where right-wing people are working with progressives. And that is the understanding that it is basically insane and counterproductive that in the United States of America today, we have 2.2 million people in jail. 2.2 million people, disproportionately African-American, Latino, and Native American. We are spending $80 billion a year locking people up. So if you're a conservative and you're just worried about money, you're saying, geez, that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it make more sense to make sure these kids are in school, they have decent jobs, than locking them up? And then you got the whole issue of police department reform, understanding that lethal force should be the last response, not the first response. Training police officers, and it's a very difficult job being a cop today, to understand that we can how to deal with people with mental illness, for example. So there is a lot that has to be done, understanding that we should not have the rate of recidivism that we do, that when people leave jail, they should be prepared to return to civil society with education and jobs. So that is a very significant issue that needs a lot of work.
Number six, you referenced earlier in this conversation, it's combating climate change. Since you referenced it earlier, let me tweak my question and ask something a bit different, which is how concerned are you that President-elect Donald Trump and his administration will just not take the science on this or any other issue seriously?
Tavis, this is a monumental issue. And it's not just obviously an American issue. This is an issue that impacts the whole planet. You know, and it is, I only can hope, let's be clear, Donald Trump is not a dummy. And let's simply hope that the scientific community can get to him and say, you know, Mr. President, you are wrong. Climate change is not a hoax. It is a frightening reality for our planet, for billions of people. And I'll tell you, Tavis, if the United States withdraws from the effort to combat climate change, this is a message that goes to every country in the world. It goes to Russia, China, India, Europe. Why are they going to transform their energy system when the largest economy on Earth is not doing it? This means that the planet we're going to be leaving our kids and our grandchildren and future generations will not be a healthy planet, to say the least.
Your protestation notwithstanding, it's so abundantly clear, given what he said during the campaign, that Trump thinks climate change is a hoax.
Look, you're right. But all I can hope is, and it's a hope, is that when you become president and you're not out there pandering to various sections of our population or representing the fossil fuel industry, that when you sit down in an office with scientists who say, Mr. President, this is what's going to happen in 5 or 10 years or 20 years if we do not transform our energy system. Let us hope that Mr. Trump is smart enough and open enough to hear their concerns.
Number five on your list is making higher education affordable. It is the one issue that you and Secretary Clinton agreed on when you got out of the campaign. You campaigned with her specifically on this issue. Sadly, though, you nor she will get a chance to enact that plan. Of course, you're still in the Senate, but how do we move forward on this issue?
Well, this one, the issue is simple enough. It says that in a highly competitive global economy, if we're going to do better now and in the future, we need the best educated workforce we can possibly have. We used to, 30, 40 years ago, Tavis, have the highest percentage of college graduates of any country on Earth. That is no longer the case, and the gap between other countries and us is growing wider. That does not look well for the future for us if they have better educated workforce. So what do we do? What we do is, for a start, make certain that public colleges and universities are tuition-free. That sends a message to every kid in this country who grew up in a family like mine, where my parents never went to college, that if they study hard and take school seriously, yeah, they'll make it to college and make it into the middle class. It is a very significant issue. We also have to deal with the issue of student debt, millions of people really being saddled with incredible debt, which impacts their lives. Trump talked about it, and one of the things that I intend to do, and others will do, is we are going to remind Mr. Trump of all that he said on the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. He talked about being a champion for the working class. Well, we're going to hold him to account.
Number four on your list is health care for all, and I want to ask before you answer, address this issue, whether or not you are in any way heartened by what Mr. Trump said on 60 Minutes regarding Obamacare, that there were some provisions that he wants to protect. He wants to protect the pre-existing conditions provision. He wants to protect the provision where kids staying at home who are still on their parents' insurance. So there are at least a couple parts of Obamacare he says he wants to keep, although during the campaign he made it very clear, repeal and replace. What do you make of what he said?
Well, I think in terms of Obamacare and in many other areas, you're going to see him rethinking the rhetoric that he espoused during the campaign. But here is the issue. The issue is we are, and I talk about this at great length in the book, whole chapter on it. We are the only country major country on earth that doesn't guarantee health care to all people, and yet we end up spending significantly more per capita on health care than do the people of any other country. That's pretty crazy stuff. I live 50 miles away from the Canadian border. They have a single-payer health care system, works pretty well. They spend much less per capita. So my view is that we have got to move, get insurance companies out of health insurance. It should not be a profit-making situation. We've got to move to health care for all in a cost-effective way, which to me is a Medicare for all single-payer system.
Donald Trump said repeatedly that he thought the campaign, that the election specifically, was rigged. Your third point is that we have to end a rigged economy. What do you mean by a rigged economy?
Again, these are issues that as a nation we do not talk enough about. What do I mean by a rigged economy? What I mean is that today, in terms of distribution of wealth, and I hope people hear this, top 1/10 of 1%, not 1%, 1/10 of 1% owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. In the last several decades, there has been a massive transfer, trillions of dollars, from the middle class to the top 1/10 of 1%. It means that today, while people are working two or three jobs, people working 50, 60 hours a week, 52% of all new income is going to the top 1%. It means that you have a handful of large financial institutions, six, in fact, that have a GDP that is equivalent to 58, that have assets equivalent to 58% of the GDP. So what you have is an economy today that is working very, very well for large multinational corporations, very well for the top 1%, while the middle class continues to decline and 43 million people live in poverty. That's a rigged economy.
Number two on your list is the decline of the American middle class and how we have to fix that. Let me ask this question, and I'm not naive in asking this, but why is it that all the data is clearly indicative of the fact that the middle class, in fact, has declined in some ways? The middle class has all but disappeared, and yet in any campaign for the White House, like the one we just endured, everybody in the campaign continues to talk about the middle class as opposed to talking about what happened to the middle class.
Well, then you got to go to section one of the book, which is fighting against oligarchy. What you have right now, this is the way politicians look at it. What they're saying is, first of all, I got to raise $1 billion+, and I get the money from the wealthy and the powerful, and I got to pay attention to their needs. Poor people, Tavis, in case you haven't noticed, do not go to $10,000 a plate fundraising dinners. So in that sense, they become irrelevant. Voting ratios for low-income people is not particularly high. So why do I have to pay attention to them? They don't contribute to the campaign. They don't vote. They become invisible. On the other hand, obviously, a handful of wealthy people will contribute to half of my campaign for an average politician. Those are the people I have to pay attention to. But what we have right now is a middle class which for 40 years has been in decline. We're better off today than we were 8 years ago. But for 40 years, what we have seen is a middle class in decline. Average people, you know why people voted for Trump? Because they are making less in real income today than they did 40 years ago. And they are seeing almost all new income and wealth going to the top 1%. And they are crying out and they're saying, I can't afford childcare for my kids. I'm 50 years of age and I got nothing in the bank and I'm about to retire in a few years. Or I just saw my job go to China and I'm earning half of what I did 3 years ago. Who is listening to me? I am worried that my kid will have a lower standard of living than I do, won't be able to pay off his or her loans, won't be able to afford to go to college. Who is hearing my pain? Not the television, not corporate media. No one's paying attention to them there. Has the Democratic Party been doing the right thing by those people? Absolutely not. And, you know, that's why Trump picks up votes there. But bottom line is, and what this book is about, is to say, here is what we can do to transform our economy so that it represents the needs of the middle class. Raise the minimum wage, pay equity for women, rebuild our infrastructure and create millions of decent paying jobs, a new trade policy so the corporations cannot just shut down in America and go abroad. Start investing in our young people so that we don't have 30% unemployment in minority youth communities. There is a lot that we can do, and the book, I think, spells it out pretty clearly.
And so now we arrive at the first thing on your list that you just referenced, defeating oligarchy. There are some who say that the reason why you are not president today is because you were anti-Wall Street, you were anti-wealth, you're anti-corporate America. You know the old adage that America in some ways was a corporation before it was even a country. And when you use the word oligarchy or use the word plutocracy, it turns some people off when you don't refer to it as a democracy. So how do you go about defeating oligarchy?
No, I don't agree with that assertion. I think most people... I mean, the problem is the oligarchs know that we're an oligarchy. They feel pretty good about it. What do the Koch brothers want? You know, the Koch brothers, you know, and we should, it's amazing how little discussion there is about what the Koch brothers actually stand for. Tavis, the Koch brothers don't want to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and federal aid to education. They want to abolish it all. Abolish it. They want to take us back to the 1920s when working people, the middle class, poor people, had absolutely no rights at all. And by the way, that is the first chapter in the book because of all of the rest, this concerns me the most. Mm-hmm. And that is as a result of Citizens United, we are losing our democratic tradition. Billionaires are buying elections. Follow what happened in just the last week or two of this campaign. The billionaires poured huge amounts of money. I'm talking about tens and tens of millions of dollars into Wisconsin, into New Hampshire, into New Mexico, into Pennsylvania to make sure that their candidates for the Senate won. And I'll tell you this, and you're hearing it first, people like Mitch McConnell are not satisfied with Citizens United. They want to go further. They want to end, as what the Koch brothers want, end all campaign finance regulations, meaning, Tavis, you want to run for the United States Senate? Just go to some billionaire, write you out a check for a few hundred million dollars. You work for that billionaire. Mm. That is the direction we are moving in. That's what they want, and they're moving in that direction. That is not democracy in any stretch of the imagination. Mm. That is oligarchy. Furthermore, if I may say, it's not only billionaires buying elections through Citizens United. It is the vicious, ugly attempt at voter suppression. I am embarrassed, I have to tell you what you already know, that in the year 2016, after all of the struggles that we have gone through as a nation for voting rights, you got Republican cowardly governors all over this country trying to make it harder for poor people, for old people, for people of color, young people to vote. How disgraceful is that? Combine big money in politics, voter suppression, both of which will increase under Trump unless we stop them. You're not looking at a democracy, I have to tell you. You're looking at an oligarchy.
And there you have it, straight from the mouth of Bernie Sanders. His new text is called Our Revolution, A Future to Believe In. Senator Sanders, thank you for coming on this program throughout this campaign. And appreciate you, sir.
And Tavis, thank you for the great work you do.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. During his campaign, President-elect Donald Trump said he would repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. But since his meeting with President Obama, which took place just days after his election win, Trump appeared to soften his position. He claimed that he'd like to keep some provisions, including one that allows young Americans to stay on their parents' health care plan longer. Dr. Robert Ross is president and CEO of the California Endowment, here to talk now about the future of Obamacare under President-elect Donald Trump. Dr. Ross, all right, sir, good to see you.
Good to see you, sir.
You saw the 60 Minutes thing with Donald Trump?
I missed it, but I heard about it.
You heard about it. So you heard then that he is backed up a bit off of his pledge to just outright repeal and replace Obamacare. Said on 60 Minutes that he saw a couple of provisions that were worth keeping. Mm-hmm. Pre-existing conditions.
Yes.
Kids staying on their parents' insurance for
extended period.
Exactly. Yes. So, at least there are two provisions that he wants to keep. Did that give you any solace?
Well, I would say it's slightly better than the scorched earth rhetoric we heard beforehand and during the campaign.
Right.
You know, what's interesting about Obamacare is when you tease out the various elements, the pillars of Obamacare, the prevention aspect, mm-hmm. making sure everyone is covered, getting rid of the discriminatory practices mm-hmm. of health insurance companies, you know, dropping someone or excluding someone because they had the audacity to come down with breast cancer or develop diabetes. When you look at making sure that quality of care is improving, when you have a standard benefit package, all of these things, they all poll quite well with mm-hmm. the public. So the public seems to be in love with the individual provisions mm-hmm. of the Affordable Care Act. They just don't like Obamacare for some reason, the package. And so I think President-elect Trump is going to find a hard time getting 20 million people to understand that they don't want to throw them off the health coverage. To get folks who have pre-existing conditions like cancer and severe diabetes to understand that you know what, we're not going to let insurance companies do that to you anymore and exclude you anymore. And how are we going to pay for that kind of support? Because healthcare remains unaffordable. That's the last, I think, bugaboo for the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare to fix. And I think that's the one we need to focus on. But he's going to have a hard time with the replace part of repeal and replace because it's not that easy.
So there are two questions that I want to ask now based on what you just said, Dr. Ross. One is he suggested in this 60 Minutes conversation, which I find somewhat unbelievable, but suggested that not even for 2 days, certainly not for 2 years, would people just fall through the cracks once he decides to replace and repeal. I don't know how you do that. How do you tell these 20 million people, we got a whole new deal for you, and literally from one day to the next, according to him, the plans just shift.
You and me both.
Yeah. How do you do that?
It's not an easy path. I mean, look, so Medicare and Medicaid passed in 1965. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen significant or meaningful health policy reform change in this country since then, mm-hmm. until Obamacare. That was 50 years.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because it wasn't easy. It's very difficult. You have a number of ways to go at it. You can go the public way mm-hmm. with single payer and public option or Medicare for all. Mm-hmm. What Obamacare was built upon were, interestingly, some conservative and Republican ideas. Mm-hmm. Obamacare is nothing but Romney Care in Massachusetts applied at national scale. Mm-hmm. Some of the provisions of Obamacare, such as the mandate, the insurance mandate mm-hmm. to make sure that everyone gets in the pool so you can pay for people who have cancer, mm-hmm. and competition, open competition in the marketplace, which is what the health exchanges were about, those are Republican Heritage Foundation ideas. Mm-hmm. So dismantling Obamacare and then overnight coming up with something that provides mm-hmm. a pathway for those people to maintain their coverage with the same things they like about it, I don't see the path either, but I'm certainly willing to have us take a look at how we can help get there.
So why is it, you said something very profound earlier, why is it then that people like the provisions of Obamacare but don't like the package? What is it about the package that gets in the way?
Well, the X factor has been political vitriol. It was certainly public enemy number one mm-hmm. On the Republican agenda from the time it passed. But I think the X factor in getting there, if we can think about a path to get there, is going to be the health insurance industry itself. How they show up in this conversation, Tavis, is going to be fascinating mm-hmm. because, you know, the healthcare sector, this is what, 18% of GDP? Mm-hmm. It's a major part of our economy.
Yeah.
Health insurance carriers stand to benefit a lot if Obamacare gets fixed. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't get fixed and they repeal it and try and replace it with something new, that's uncertainty and a whole entirely new dynamic for the health insurance industry.
Yeah.
So I think health insurance executives may show up in the White House helping President Trump-elect figure out a pathway to get there so that he can come away with some kind of whatever political chops he needs to say he repealed it, mm-hmm. but replace it with something that is not so unsettling and uncertain. Yeah.
How much pressure, and I'm not naive in asking this, but how much pressure you think he faces, though, to do what he said he was going to do, which is to repeal most of those provisions, save those two, because that's what he told a whole bunch of Americans who voted for him, that's what he was going to do.
Yeah, he's got to satisfy 45 million people over the number of ones that voted for mm-hmm. him, but he also has to answer to the 20 million people who got covered. 20 million people is a lot of people.
Yeah.
That'd be the third biggest state in the country. That's probably bigger than, if it was a nation, that's mm-hmm. bigger than 150 nations.
Yeah.
Imagine all those people who are affected by Obamacare marching on Washington, mm-hmm. Tavis. D.C. couldn't hold them.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So you have to figure out a way to speak to the 20 million and their family mm-hmm. members, okay? Because remember, pre-Obamacare, 20% of the nation was uninsured. That's now down to 9%.
Yeah.
Before Obamacare, kids who were 25, 26-year-old on their parents' coverage, Now their families like that. Mm-hmm. Parents like their kids mm-hmm. having some security as they transition to adulthood. Mm-hmm. So how he manages to walk that fine line between the people that voted for him under that repeal of Obamacare rhetoric and the 20 million people who now have been benefited, mm-hmm. I don't see the path today, but I think that's what they'll be working on.
Some of those 20 million people work with me.
Sure.
And over the last few months, and this won't surprise you because it became a national news story, some of the folks who literally work with me have been complaining about the fact that their premiums have gone up.
Sure.
So what do you say to those persons, even those who voted for Barack Obama?
Yes.
Who are seeing these premiums increase and they're not happy either?
Yeah. That's the fairest objective critique of Obamacare.
Right.
I would give it some context. Number one, even before Obamacare, healthcare premiums were going up every year for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And healthcare increases in costs have always outpaced inflation. So we've never had a handle on healthcare mm-hmm. costs in the first place, even before Obamacare. Secondly, this is a very complicated, complex piece of legislative apparatus. It is the most complex policy legislation probably in 50 or 60 years in the country. Mm-hmm. We knew, even those of us who advocated for it, and Obamacare wasn't my first choice. I'm a single payer advocate,
sure,
quite frankly.
You and me both, yeah.
So, but we knew that something this complicated was going to take 3 to 4 years to settle in, see what the numbers look like, mm-hmm. and then fix what's not right. I mean, you know, when you hear a funny noise in your car engine, mm-hmm. you don't run right to the car dealership and say, hey, man, trade this in. I want a new car. Mm-hmm. You take it to a mechanic. You get the mechanic, get under the hood, and you fix it. And you try and get the bug worked out. And that's where we are, I think, mm-hmm. with Obamacare on the cost issue. We need to work out those bugs. Now, there are some paths to fixing the cost. Mm-hmm. None of them are easy. More subsidies, federal subsidies to help offset the cost. That's not going to go well in a Republican Congress. Mm-hmm. You can dummy down or skinny down the benefit package instead of having the standard benefit package, which some people think may be too rich. Mm-hmm. You can dummy that down and get it to be a skinnier package. But now you're taking away prevention services mm-hmm. and other kinds of things. Or you can say, well, listen, let's get more healthy people, young people in the pool. And that would help offset the cost. So there are ways to manage the cost. Mm-hmm. You may need to do some combination of all three. I'm not sure. But again, not going to be an easy path for a Trump-elect administration.
Let me apologetically make you political for just a second here.
Sure.
But I know you can handle it. There is going to be a conversation for years to come as we analyze the Obama years mm-hmm. About whether or not he got it right. That is to say, whether or not he was right to do health care first, or whether he was wrong to do health care first. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got their opinion about that, or will have when these historians get done unpacking how he might have done things differently or mm-hmm. better. The question, though, is whether Donald Trump would be well served or disserved to jump on health care first or to push it somewhere down the road. I mean, the whole debate about Obama was jobs or health care, jobs or health care. Donald Trump, interestingly, could not be more different than Barack Obama, right. but faces the same conversation.
Sure.
Healthcare first or jobs first?
Yeah.
We know what
yeah.
Obama did. What should Trump do?
Well, the track record of trying to fix health policy in the country is littered with minefields and dead bodies. Mm-hmm. No less than, I mean, perhaps arguably one of the most exquisite political craftsmen in our time, Bill Clinton, mm-hmm. came in with a plan, had both houses of Congress, had his wife on mm-hmm. point running, and still couldn't get it done, mm-hmm. right? Arnold Schwarzenegger. Here mm-hmm. in California, came up with a plan similar to Obamacare for California, mm-hmm. couldn't get it done. So I think the recognition of how difficult this is job one. Mm-hmm. And I would say be careful, thoughtful, strategic. Mm-hmm. If it takes 2 to 3 years to get there, then it just takes 2 to 3 years to get there. But if he reverts back to his campaign rhetoric mm-hmm. of, in my first day in office, we're going to get rid of Obamacare. Now he's recognizing that the replace part of repeal is a much hairier animal and beast than he thought. And I think he's got to take his time and move carefully.
For those of us who think that something is better than nothing, that Obamacare is a step in the right direction, to your wonderful analogy that we got to fix what's wrong with the car, but not just turn the car in, mm-hmm. Or give up on the car. What do you say to those persons about how to exercise whatever agency they have, and you tell me what that agency is, to push back on whatever they might want to do to destroy Obamacare? What agency do they have, and how do they exercise?
Well, I think you've been as good or better at this than anybody, which is we've got to participate. Mm-hmm. Folks need to, who've benefited from the Affordable Care Act in any manner, way, shape, or form, their mm-hmm. children, their neighbor, themselves, need to speak up and speak out. Mm-hmm. What are the provisions? Don't just say, keep Obamacare. Mm-hmm. You can say, what is it that you like about it? Mm-hmm. And what is it that needs to be fixed? Mm-hmm. And see if we can bring the civic discourse on this issue to a more reasonable and rationed and engaged place, mm-hmm. rather than scorched earth campaign politics. Mm-hmm. So I think those 20 million people need to show up and speak out about how they've benefited, but also the folks who have been hurt by Obamacare in terms of increased premiums.
Yes.
Let them speak up as well, and maybe we can revisit the discourse, part of which, quite frankly, Travis, maybe we glossed over in the run-up to Obamacare, and maybe we need to have that, but let's fix things, let's fix what's broken, and not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
I take that point from Dr. Robert Ross, President and CEO of the California Endowment. Doc, it's always good to have you on. Thanks for your insights, my friend.
Thank you, my brother.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. At age 30, Ryan Speedo Green is one of opera's rising stars. He has performed at the Met and at other world-class venues around the globe. Yet his path to opera was an unlikely one. He grew up poor. He was labeled disruptive at school and even spent a few months in juvenile detention. His life is now the subject of a book by the New York Times journalist Daniel Bergner. It's called Sing for Your Life, a story of race, music, and family. Before we start our conversation with Speedo, first, a look at him singing in La Boheme. To really appreciate that clip, and to put it in its proper context, I want to ask you to read a letter that you wrote to Mrs. Hughes.
Okay. Mind you, this is written when I was in fourth grade, so when and my very perfect literary style. So just know that when I say heart, I mean hurt. Mm-hmm. Okay. Dear Mrs. Hughes, I made a great fool of myself. I admit I did yell at him. I haven't been starting the day right. Even though I'm sitting in the seat, I am listening. I will try to start over. I see how better everyone would be when I'm not here. People say life would be better without Ryan. And now I know they are telling the truth. You may think I am mean-hearted, but I'm not. I don't want to hurt anyone. I've always said I could work on it, but it's just happening again. Thank you for not giving up on me, because it shows me I can do it if I try. Your student, Ryan.
All right, so you were how old then?
I was probably 9 years old.
And Mrs. Hughes was?
Ms. Hughes was my fourth grade elementary school teacher.
Okay.
I was in a class of the worst kids in the district, about 6 or 7 kids who were handpicked from different schools in the district.
This is where?
This is in Virginia, southeastern Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And picked from Yorktown, Grafton area, and put in a class because they were incapable of being around other students for violence, for language. And you know, the first day that I met Mrs. Hughes, the way I introduced myself is I threw my desk at her. And instead of sending me home to the principal, usually what would happen, you know, send you home to the principal calls your mom, you go home. Yeah. She took my chair away and told me when I'm ready to learn from my desk, I can have my chair and my desk back.
Right.
So that was just sort of the beginning of her like not giving up on me. And the next thing she taught me right after that was the Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream speech. She taught it not only to me as an African American, but she taught it to the Caucasian kids in class, the Hispanic kids in class, because she wanted all of us to know that in this class, we would not be judged by our color, but by the content of our character.
Mm. What were you so angry about as a kid?
You know, that's an incredibly tough question to ask, isn't it? You know, because as a kid, you're angry at a lot of things, angry at maybe what's happening at home, which had a lot of family problems, and I think, for me, looking back, I was probably didn't like myself. I probably did not accept kindness from others because I just didn't like who I was as a person, as a child, and so I had many outbursts, physical, vocal, because I didn't know how to deal with a dislike in myself. And I think that happens to a lot of children and teenagers who are in the same position.
I'm just curious. Mrs. Hughes was white?
Yes, she was.
Yeah, yeah. What did you learn? What was your takeaway from her not giving up on you at such an early age?
I think it's a sign of a good educator. Like, mm-hmm. she was a woman who wanted to be a teacher her whole life. But she talks about it in the book that Daniel Bergner wrote in Sing for Your Life about, you know, being a 9-year-old and teaching her dolls and things like this. And mm-hmm. and I think when she had such a love to help others, you know, she had a husband and a child who grew up to be a surgeon. They were not low-income family by any means, mm-hmm. but she had a desire to help all children, no matter what color, no matter what creed, to discover that they're worth something.
Mm. The singing. How did you discover that you had this gift?
It's funny enough. You know, I've read this book 4 times, mm-hmm. and I still it still leaves me in awe of how I actually had the love for music before I had the voice for music. Mm-hmm. And I told Dan, when we were working on the book, that you know I never really had the gift when I first fell in love with it, mm-hmm. And he obviously that can't be true, and he went and spoke with teachers and faculty and people who were around me when I was young and even in college, and no, they were like, it wasn't all there. And I think what's special, I think, about this field is that there's a lot of people who love opera who are not good at singing it. I just was one of the lucky ones who ended up having a gift in it.
But your love for music was not initially opera, though.
Despite preconceptions, I never was in church choir before I started singing classical music. Yeah. I wasn't going around singing. I listened to hip hop and R&B because it's in my blood. It's what I grew up with. But it was just by happenstance that I took a field trip with a Magnet School for the Arts, mm-hmm. to go see an opera in New York City. So I came from southeastern Virginia, and in my freshman year or sophomore year of high school, I saw my first opera, and it happened to be at the Metropolitan Opera.
Who'd you see that day?
And what made it so big, what made it so poignant, not only was it, you know, the Met is it's like Disneyland for opera, mm-hmm. but the thing that made it so monumental is that the lead character in the opera, which was Carmen, was an African-American mezzo-soprano by the name of Denise Graves.
Who's awfully good.
You know, I imagine I'm a 15-year-old boy watching this beautiful woman on stage making me laugh, making me cry, maybe making me feel every emotion on the emotional spectrum, mm-hmm. and then I got to meet her afterwards. And when I met her, and I realized that this person is just like my mom's best friend. She treated me like I was her nephew, or you know, someone close to her, and hugged me, took pictures with me, called me her boo, and
on a black kid knees.
Yes.
I want a woman to call you her boo.
and I fell in love, and I left the Metropolitan Opera thinking that this is something I can do, because before that I thought opera was something only a white person could do.
Yeah.
And it made it tangible for me. And when I left the Met, I was with my voice teacher who's also African American, and his name is Robert Brown, and I told him, you know, I want to sing at the Met. That's what I want to do. And that was my first, and I think in my life, that I ever had a dream that I thought was tangible.
Yeah.
A dream that I wanted to have, and it changed my life.
Yeah. And what, fast forward and we'll come back, what then did you feel? How do you describe the way you felt on the day that you, in fact, appeared a decade later at the Met?
It was epic. I mean, when I auditioned for it was a competition that brought me to the Metropolitan Opera, and the biggest competition in the U.S. for opera. And I did it in a region in Colorado just for feedback, because I wanted to see where I stood in my career, and I ended up making it to the semifinals on the Met stage. And when I walked on, when they say, you know, there are moments when athletes, you know, compare, mm-hmm. you know, to maybe the football, when you make it to NFL and you get that first tryout with the mm-hmm. NFL teams, all the NFL teams sitting out there, that's how I felt. I was in tears. It was almost impossible to mm-hmm. sing.
Yeah.
But luckily I pulled it together. But it was you know, reaching a dream in any, you know, as a child, reaching any dream as an adult is humbling and magnificent. And it's still today, 5 years later since I debuted at the Met, I still feel that feeling whenever I step on the stage.
Yeah. Your NFL reference is interesting and telling, because when a brother your size walks into an audition for opera, what kind of reactions do you get?
You know, when I talked about preconceptions about, you know, you know, people thinking that I started off in gospel.
Yeah.
You know, when a 300-pound, 6'4", 6'5" black man walks into an audition, you know, there could be small preconceptions that even happened then. Like maybe, oh, I hope his diction is good. I hope he can actually sing in Italian. Mm-hmm. Or like, oh, you know, I hope he doesn't have a gospel sound.
Yeah.
And these are small preconceptions, but you know, in the big picture, they affect casting. They affect lots of things. So. There's different reactions. Luckily, I live in the operatic field is one of the most free fields for artistic expression.
Mm-hmm. By free, you mean what?
They're able to both art, about body type. Like you don't like mm-hmm. For instance, now the Met is no longer doing blackface in Otello, which is huge. And so now the idea that maybe a man who is my size can play a lover instead of playing just a villain, or mm-hmm. maybe someone who is short can play someone who's actually supposed to be tall, or someone who's supposed to be a beautiful, enchanting woman. They're not beautiful, enchanting because of maybe that they're a size zero, but because their voice and their character shows mm-hmm. that. So that opera allows suspension of maybe disbelief,
sure,
I guess,
sure.
Because it more focuses more on the voice and the artistry than maybe more the looks of what someone fits and the color of their skin.
You've had some great successes, no doubt about it. How has this dream felt for you? Put another way, has all of this measured up to what you hoped and dreamed that day you first went to see Denise Gray?
You know, when I thought of my dream as a teenager, it was a dream that was almost selfish, I would say, like, you know, wanting to achieve something, to get out of the trailer park, to get out of my hometown, to get away from the things that kept me down, or the things that I thought
from juvenile delinquency.
Yeah, juvenile delinquency, exactly. And it gave me an outlet mm-hmm. for my emotions, for all of the trauma that I experienced at a young age, and I was able to to have an outlet, artistic outlet per se, to express myself, and it gave me a focus like nothing I'd ever experienced. Mm-hmm. But now as an adult, you know, reaching my dream, being able to, you know, perform at some of the greatest opera houses in the world, now has given me another outlet to give back. And, you know, I think as much as, singing at the Met has been a dream, it's even the opportunities, the book and working on the book has allowed me to do, going back to the juvenile detention facility that I stayed at mm-hmm. in Virginia and talking with those kids and speaking with them, because of the connections that I got through Daniel working on the book and him mm-hmm. getting my records and talking with people, I was able to go back and speak to the kids there now. And even recently, I was in Santa Cruz visiting the juvenile detention there and speaking to the kids just to let them know, man, like, look at me, like, look what I'm doing. I bet you never even thought you would see a person who looks at me to sing mm-hmm. in an opera, but anything's possible. Let this be the lowest part of your life. Let this be the worst part of your life, so when you leave here, you can only go forward and only go up.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.